It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. At least five women have publicly accused the spouse of the UW-Whitewater chancellor, who held a ceremonial and unpaid role on campus, of sexual harassment. We learn more about the scope of these investigations from Karen Herzog, a higher education reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's been covering this issue since the beginning. Karen, good morning and welcome to the morning show.
Good morning, John. Thank you.
Per your reporting, at least five women have publicly accused Pete Hill, the spouse of UW-Whitewater's Chancellor Beverly Copper, of sexual harassment. Where are we with this investigation?
Well, a third investigation has been launched into claims that he sexually harassed women on the UW-Whitewater campus. The first investigation was in 2017, and in that case, the claim was unsubstantiated. But at that time, Mr. Hill was required to take sexual harassment training. It was the second investigation earlier this year by an independent investigator for UW System that prompted President of the System, Ray Cross, to strip the title, the honorary role, from Mr. Hill and ban him from campus. Now, after I published the story on Friday, based on documents that I obtained through an open records request, a fifth woman, the last, most recent, well, actually she's not the last woman, a fourth woman came forward Friday after reading the story, and she is a Whitewater City Councilwoman. Shortly after she came forward, a fifth woman came forward to the Chronicle of Higher Education. She works in higher education, and I have not been told whether there's a separate investigation on that. It's unclear whether she reported her claims to UW System.
Is there a sense that there will be more allegations coming out?
Typically in these cases, that happens once a couple of individuals come forward. If there are others who want to come forward but previously have been afraid to, they may do so. Now, the investigator in the investigation over the summer said that she felt there was a pattern of behavior in Mr. Hill and that he didn't acknowledge that there was a problem. In fact, he has vehemently denied all of the allegations against him. So it's unclear whether that will happen, but there have been comments from several people who contacted Senator Steve Noss that there is a climate on campus that people are afraid, if they have concerns, to take them to the chancellor's office, to the administration, and that's why they went to a state senator for help.
So when was the campus made aware of these allegations?
The campus was not made aware of these allegations until Friday, when the Journal Sentinel first published its report on the allegations against the chancellor's husband. She was made aware of the results of the investigation that found him to have committed these acts in June. She did not notify the campus at that time. She did not notify the campus that her husband was banned from activities. It's unclear who knew, if anyone other than her and UW System, that he was not allowed to be on campus. She waited. She could have told the campus at that time, but chose not to.
What was Hill's role on the campus? What was he doing?
He had a ceremonial role. It was unpaid, and it was an honorary position, but it was a high profile position. He basically was involved in fundraising and athletics, especially fundraising for athletics, golf outings, things like that. Also alumni events, and he attended a lot of formal function dinners. Galas, all kinds of things that made him gave him a lot of access to women who would work at the university, and as well as that students. Two of the individuals who have come forward are former students.
Do you know if this type of role is typical for the spouses of chancellors in the UW system?
Yes, it is not an unusual situation. There are three other chancellors currently in the UW system who are women. I know that UW-Madison Chancellor Becky Blank's husband also has an honorary position. It's not unusual because typically in entertaining, if you're married, your spouse may be there, and it's considered something that is good for the university to have the full support of a couple when one member is the chancellor of a university.
What is Chancellor Copper saying about this?
Chancellor Copper, when she issued her statement on Friday to the campus, it was 4 minutes after the UW system released the records to me. She said that it was a difficult situation and that it was something that she normally would not discuss personnel issues publicly, but she had the permission of the UW system to do so. She said she supported the decision and put it into effect immediately when her husband was banned. She also said that it was her top priority to make sure that UW-Whitewater is a welcoming campus and a positive and safe environment for everyone there.
How long has she been at UW-Whitewater?
She's been at UW-Whitewater since 2010. Prior to being named chancellor in 2015, she was a provost. So she has been in a role on campus that would put her in close proximity to students, although Mr. Hill would not have had a role on the campus until 2015.
Mm-hmm. Karen Herzog is the higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about allegations of sexual harassment, which have been levied against the spouse of the chancellor at UW-Whitewater. It's an ongoing situation. The story broke this past Friday, and we're talking about it here this morning. So what are some of the specifics that we know about these allegations?
Typically, the allegations involve suggestive comments, sexually suggestive comments. And he apparently is a hugger. He is considered very gregarious, always has a smile, greeted several of these women with hugs whenever he saw them. So there was uncomfortable physical contact. However, in the case of the Whitewater City Councilwoman, his comments about her appearance and romantic relationships became more brazen. She was a student government leader. And it escalated to the point in 2015 after she had graduated. She was a councilwoman, and she ran into him outside a coffee shop, and she said that she was wearing a skirt. He hugged her, and he touched her inappropriately.
Mm. How's the campus and community reacting to this story since it broke?
Well, there's obviously a lot of shock. It's not a typical thing to happen. It's a very unusual case. It's also unusual in that it's the woman who's being asked to resign from a position based on sexual harassment allegations that are against her husband. So the situation is that she's in a position of responsibility to the university, but she also has a responsibility and obligation to her husband. So she's caught between, the proverbial rock and hard place, and that she's got conflicting interests.
And what are you, there are those who are calling for the resignation of the chancellor. Why do they think she should resign?
They believe she should resign because of the climate on campus that they say she has created, that there is a climate of fear, that there may be more women who would want to come forward. There's also concern about how she handled this, that she didn't bring it forward to the campus earlier, that perhaps she should have done that, and there are also questions about what did she know about her husband's behavior and when, and whether that could open the campus up to liability legally with women who filed claims against her husband.
Karen Herzog, thank you very much for joining me this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Karen Herzog is higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm John Munson. This is the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. One of the hottest topics in higher education today is student debt. The numbers nationwide are staggering. The average University of Wisconsin student graduates with $30,000 worth of student loans to pay off. Are you a Wisconsin grad struggling with student loan debt? Tell us about your experience. What changes do you think need to be made to deal with the problem of student loan debt in our state? Are you a student at the UW? Do you think the tuition freeze is helpful when it comes to covering college costs? Are you a student at a Wisconsin technical college? What has your experience been paying for college? Are you a low-income student? Did you receive a Pell Grant? Did you have to take special measures in order to afford school, like taking a semester off to work? What do you think should be done to address the graduation gap between low-income students and others? How can the state make college more accessible for low-income students and other people? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest this hour is Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. His piece about student debt is called "Wisconsin Grads Carry an Average of $30,000 in Student Loans. Is That Changing?" Keegan, good morning and welcome to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
In 2016, Wisconsin had the 17th highest average student debt in the nation. So what, if anything, has changed in the past 2 years?
Yeah, what's really changed or been notable is a lack of change. So if you go back decades, even in Wisconsin, there's been a very gradual rise in tuition in the state, as well as levels of debt that students have been taking out to pay for college. Except over the past 4 or 5 years or so, that those increases have started to level off. So students are taking out about the same amounts of debt as they were last year or 2 years ago. Also some other measures, this measure called unmet need, has leveled off as well. Unmet need is basically a measure that is often used in higher education to look at how much need for financial aid do students have after grants, loans, scholarships, and what is their family able to pay. So it's very important in tracking what is the financial cost of college and how is that pressuring families.
So you mentioned that tuition started to go up. Did other forms of non-borrowing, a non-loan-based student aid go up along with tuition?
I'm not sure what you mean.
As tuition started to go up, were there other forms of financial aid that increased along with that? So, say, Pell Grants, other forms of direct aid that weren't based on borrowing. Did those go up as well or not?
Got it, yes. So there have been several steps. Back around 2010, there was a surge in eligibility for Pell Grants, and so a lot more students in Wisconsin started to receive federal financial aid around 2010 compared to previous years. Last year, state lawmakers also approved an increase of $15 million increase in state grants, and those grants are cash in pocket, so you don't have to pay them back like you do loans. So those have definitely eased the burden on a lot of families who are trying to send students to college. Pell Grants can be cash in pocket, so those are things that you don't have to pay back. There's also quite a range of federal loan packages that students now have access to as well. So there are some options for students to pay a much lower cost than the sticker price to attend college. Some other, at individual campuses, there has been a lot of push to increase institutional grants through private donations to raise money that way. Or at one college like UW-Madison has a program that specifically targets low-income families where they can have a lot of their tuition and fees waived if they fall under a certain income threshold.
So student debt in Wisconsin has leveled off at about $30,000 over the past few years. So how are we supposed to read this? Is this a sign the problem is being solved, or at least it's not getting worse?
Yeah, I lean towards at least it's not getting worse. I think the measure of $30,000 is significant because that's a very large amount of money for a lot of families. you know, the average median income, household income in Wisconsin is somewhere in the range of $55,000-$60,000. And so a $30,000 loan when you're leaving college is a significant amount of money for a lot of families. And Wisconsin does have families that take out loans at much higher rates than elsewhere in the country. So a lot of people are facing debt after college and continue to face debt after college, and that has an array of ramifications on their financial choices in the future, things like buying a car or buying a house. If you fall into problems paying back your debt, so if you go into federal default, that can hurt your financial prospects for years to come through a lower credit score and other steps as well. So it remains a very large issue.
So let's talk about what kinds of loans these are, because I think for some of us, myself included, who went to a college, say, in the early 70s, that was a long time ago, the student loan programs available at that time were federally backed. They were strictly regulated. The interest rates were very low. What we're hearing today, though, is that the kinds of student loans that students are taking out are much different. And for one thing, the interest rates are a lot higher and they're much more difficult to pay back. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think there are a lot more options in the field today, I think, for where students can get loans. So you still have federal loan programs that a lot of students can qualify for. You also have private loans out there that students can apply for. Typically, the federal loans will have lower interest rates. There are also more types of financial protections for those. And there are programs that can help students pay back loans over time. There are also now programs in the private sector to help students refinance their loans. So if you do have high interest rates, you can go to a credit union in Wisconsin and see if maybe repackaging your loans can bring your interest rate down and make it a little bit more manageable.
I mean, $30,000 is still a lot of debt to contend with. I mean, that's considerably more than I paid for my first house. How are the people you've met reporting this story dealing with that debt? What are some of the stories you've heard?
Yeah, one of the stories that we highlighted in most recently was a student who recently graduated and was fortunate to get a job right out of college, and he just started paying lots of money to try to pay down his level of debt, and it really changed his lifestyle, what he was able to afford each month and what he was able to enjoy. So because he was pouring so much of his salary into paying his loan payments back. And ultimately, he had to make this choice about what type of lifestyle he wanted to live. Did he want to be spending so much of his paycheck every month to get rid of this mountain of debt, which for him was more than $50,000, or did he want to make lower payments each month and kind of have this debt lingering for much longer time, but he would have more money in his pocket in the short term? And I think that's a very, very familiar story to a lot of families that come out of college and now have to make this choice about what type of lifestyle are they able to live or do they want to live to pay off this debt over time? Is this debt something that you want to get rid of quickly, but then you're going to be paying a lot of money up front, or do you want to stretch it out over a very long time and you're paying a lot more money then because of interest, or you just have this debt lingering in your background for a very long time? And so I think it affects lifestyles in a lot of different ways.
So $30,000 is the average. What was the highest amount you found as you were reporting the story that a student reported to you?
Oh, yeah. And we've talked to students with more than $70,000 in debt for an undergraduate degree, not a medical degree or a law degree, but for an undergraduate degree. Particularly students who attend private schools where the tuition can be much higher, where there might not be as much access to certain financial aid packages, those students can come out with much higher levels of debt as well. And it's Yeah.
$70,000, that's a staggering amount of money. It's something, I mean, you know, a 30-year mortgage for $70,000 would be a considerable chunk. We're at news time. We're going to continue our conversation with Keegan Kyle about student loan debt in Wisconsin. We have some callers who want to join us. We'll take them right after the news, and we need to hear from you as well. What's your student loan story? 800-642-1234. Keegan Kyle is an investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. His piece about student debt, titled "Wisconsin Grads Carry an Average of $30,000 in Student Loans, Is That Changing?" is the basis for today's discussion. We'll be back after this short break. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Students are graduating from college with crippling amounts of student loans, and we're talking about that today on The Morning Show with Keegan Kyle, an investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, who's been looking into this issue. We have a lot of callers who want to join us, and let's start with Mark from Appleton. Mark, good morning. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have to say it's rather frustrating that you're this far into the show without a single word being mentioned about the massive state cuts to universities, both in Wisconsin and throughout the country, which has, of course, been made up by tuition increases. The state in Wisconsin used to support a student attending college by more than 60% of the cost. It's now less than 30%. And so, of course, tuition has risen, and now we're surprised that we have all this student debt. This actually goes back to years where there's actually a model of high tuition, high student aid, which of course leads to all of this debt. It's not to be surprised. When I went to school many years ago, it was very easy to work in the summer and pay for tuition. That's no longer possible. I teach in the UW. Many of my students are working 30 and 40 hours a week, and they still have student debt. So we shouldn't be surprised about this. If we're not willing to support the universities and our students going to school, they're going to have a high debt.
Mark, thanks for sharing that with us. Keegan, Kyle, what about that? I mean, is this really the root of the problem? The costs have gone up based on the withdrawal of state support from the UW system, and that's what's driving tuition?
Yeah, it's a very common concern that you hear in higher education. I think it's a few ways that you can kind of unpack it a little. One thing to note is that how people look at the numbers around state funding for the UW system and tuition can be looked at it a little different way. So you often hear like our funding for state UW system has been stagnant or about the same in recent times, and that's generally looking at UW funding, state funding for the UW system in pure dollars. So how much actual dollars does the state give the UW system? And that those numbers have fluctuated over the past decade, but they've been about the same in the same general range of like $200 million. You know, it sounds like a lot of money, but in the grand scheme of how much money goes to the UW system each year, they've been relatively stagnant over the past decade. What's really changed is the level of tuition. The amount of money that's come from tuition has gone up quite a bit over the past decade. And so the caller is absolutely right that tuition has taken on a much greater responsibility to shoulder the cost of education at state schools. And that is part of a national trend of less of students taking on much more the cost of their education at colleges than state funding. The two trends that the caller is talking about, the decline of state aid and the increase in tuition, is much more evident when you look at these dollars at a per student level. So how much state aid is going to the UW system per student enrolled, versus how much tuition money is going to the UW system per student enrolled that's where you really see changes over time, where the state has been giving less and less money per student since the 1990s, essentially, whereas the amount of money charged per student through tuition has been increasing almost every year since the 1970s. In 2011, it was that the students actually started to pay more for the UW system than state taxes through state funding. And every year since then, every year since 2011, students are paying more for the UW system education than state taxes.
Let's, Mark, thanks for that call. Let's take another call. Ben is with us in Sussex. Ben, go ahead.
Hi, calling. Thank you for taking my call. Calling as a recent graduate, 2012, just the idea of, one, you know, understanding the responsibility and investment that education brings, that it is going to cost money and you have to pay that down. And then talking about the lifestyle, changing your lifestyle out of college, right out of college, to pay down those debts. You know, I think that that's a huge part. That's what, you know, I worked for, and my wife and I, who also went on for a doctorate, you know, changing your lifestyle, living below your means to be able to pay down these debts so down the road you can live a different lifestyle. And just understanding that, you know, maybe college isn't for everybody. I don't think, you know, there's this huge push to get people in college. I don't think everyone belongs in college, first. And secondly, I see it as a business and supply and demand, and there's a continuous demand even at the prices that there are. So, you know, I think in terms of it, at that end, the consumerism needs to change as well.
Ben, if you don't mind my asking, how much debt did you graduate with?
It was about $25,000.
Okay, but you've been able to make those payments no problem?
Yeah, so we did that, and then, you know, on top of that, as I said, my wife went on for her doctorate at Marquette, and we were, you know, lived a lifestyle that was well below our means, and we paid cash along the way, and my wife worked full-time while obtaining her doctorate in nursing. So, you know, I think it is completely possible to do these things, but, you know, you're not going to be buying fancy new cars. You're not going to be buying big old houses and things. You're going to be living in small apartments and driving old beater cars.
Okay. Ben, thank you. Thank you for the call. Keegan, how typical would Ben's story be of the students that you talk to?
Yeah, I think it's very typical. I think one of the challenges of student debt can be coming out of college and realizing how big those loan payments are going to be and what that means for your expectations in everyday life. So are you going to be able to go to the restaurants that you want to? Are you going to be able to buy the house that you want to or the car that you want to? And sometimes the reckoning of that can be very disturbing to people who went to college and paid a lot of money and now come out with a financial situation that is different than their expectations. So I think that's like a very common frustration. But that's something that a lot of colleges and even in high schools now, people are working better to inform students about what that situation is going to look like so that they go into college with better expectations about how much the situation is going to cost and what they can expect after college.
All right. Let's take another call. This time there's another Mark. This is our morning for Marks on the morning show. Apparently Mark in Romance, Wisconsin. Mark, good morning. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for taking my call. I graduated from UW-Whitewater in 1975. My total student indebtedness at that time was $2,000. And actually, the only reason I took that loan out was I had a family emergency. Back then, corporations and the wealthy were paying a much fairer share of tax than they are now. I think it's a sad commentary that in the state of Wisconsin, our budget for the prisons is greater than it is for the university system. I was also thinking, as the last caller was talking about living, you know, a lower lifestyle. Yeah, of course you have to do that when you're dealing with student debt or going to school. But I was able to pay for all my tuition. My wife at that time was able to pay for her tuition and graduate, and we had a total $2,000 of indebtedness. I also bought my first home just 3 years after I graduated from high school. Now, as I look at retiring in a year, one thing I want to say is that, you know, spending on education is not a cost. It's an investment, whether that's for the individual or for the society. And when we start making it so difficult for people to go to college, why would a high-paying employer want to come to this state if there are poorly educated workers? And the last thing I'll say is, one, my generation has failed the people who are in college now, and for that I apologize. And two, I sure hope these young students are getting politically involved. And if you get a chance to talk to a candidate for state or federal office, put them on the spot on the issue of student debt.
Mark, thanks for the call. Keegan, Kyle, you want to comment on what Mark had to say?
Yeah, I think sounds like Mark is commenting on kind of the a few things, but certainly kind of the political relevance of college affordability this year. It is an election year. We have very prominent statewide races on the ballot. Every state assembly seat is on the ballot. Half of the state senate is on the ballot. And these are people who every 2 years make very large decisions about how much money is going to be going into the UW system, how much state money is going to be going into very prominent grant programs that can help low-income families or students on more of a merit basis. There's a lot of power in state government that over college affordability and a lot of influence. So it is a very important time of the year to be talking about college affordability, because the people who are elected in November are going to be making decisions next year that affect students for years to come.
Let's talk about the demographics of student loan debt for just a moment. Are there certain groups who get harder by student debt than others? What about that?
Sorry, you said student.
I mean, what's the face of student loan debt? We've kind of been talking about it in general terms. Are there demographic groups that get harder with student debt than others?
Yes. Yeah, and I think in some different ways. So, low-income students, in particular, tend to go to more technical colleges or two-year colleges, and those institutions often have higher rates of students defaulting on their loans. And like we talked about earlier, defaulting on your loans can have really major ramifications for a person's financial future.
Okay.
And that's something that we haven't seen really changing over time. And there are even some... Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I want to come back to that. We have to go to a break, and then because this is an important question. Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for USA Today Network in Wisconsin. We're talking about student loan debt. This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. John Munson here with you this morning. We're talking about student loan debt in Wisconsin with Keegan Kyle, an investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. And he wrote an article about this recently. He's been doing an investigation on this issue. And we're talking about that this morning. Just before our break, Keegan, we were talking about the demographics of student loans and you know, who's more likely to be taking more student loans. You were talking about some differences and some areas where there are real problems with students being able to pay back loans and some default issues. Let's continue with that, and then we'll take some more calls.
Right. So I think in the background of any conversation about college affordability, there's this concern about student debt or the cost of college deterring low-income families in particular from going to college in the first place. And there are some signs that appears to be happening, though it's unclear why. So over the past 5 years, there's been a gradual decline of low-income students attending UW system schools. If you look at the percentage of students who receive federal Pell Grants, which is a common metric that is used in higher education to track low-income students. And this could be because more low-income families are are having success in getting jobs directly out of high school. You know, the economy has been improving as well as unemployment's been going down. But there's this lingering concern that with the amount of student debt and the amount of attention that student gets across Wisconsin, that maybe fewer low-income families are actually deciding to go to college. There's also been some positive trends over the past few years with low-income families, where students, low-income families, are more often graduating in 4 years, which can help bring down their college costs. But there's this gap that still remains between low-income families and other families and how often they are able to accomplish that important benchmark. In most cases, if you're a more affluent person, you're much more likely to graduate within 4 years, which means that you can often keep down your college costs a little bit more.
So what about the technical college system? Wisconsin has an extensive system of technical colleges around the state, and a lot of students go there. What do we know about the situation there regarding student debt?
Yeah, so generally the levels of student debt are lower at technical colleges because they're much more geared to be affordable institutions. They're often a shorter program, so you're not paying as many years of tuition when you are attending. But because they do tend to market towards a group that is more financially unstable, they often have higher rates of students defaulting on their loans. And I think that's one of the tragedies about kind of technical college or community colleges, which appear to a similar audience, is that they're places where that are meant to cater to low-income families and those kind of in the most need. But they often struggle to accomplish that, to get people out of their institutions in a financial stability. And that's something very much on the radar of technical colleges. They're aware of this and they're working to improve it. And there's three that I've been monitoring that their default rates have actually been worsening slightly in recent years. And they've been doing some initiatives to try to improve how often students come out of college paying their loans, and they believe that they are going to see a turnaround in the near future where students are falling into default less often.
We've kind of established debt and unmet need have leveled off, plateaued, if you will. There's still big problems, though. What's being done to address this at the policy level? I mean, we've got Governor Scott Walker and his Democratic challenger, Tony Evers, both saying they'll extend the UW system tuition freeze if they're elected. But, you know, how effective is that going to be going forward in dealing with the problem of student debt?
Yes, so a freeze essentially helps students now. So it helps future students. So it lowers the college costs of students who are currently in college or they're going to be in college next year. It doesn't really do much to help students who are coming out of college and have a lot of debt. That's where some other proposals like refinancing your student loans, or Governor Walker has proposed giving tax credits to people who are paying off their debts. Those types of proposals are much more targeted to help people who are in a debt situation.
So if you simply freeze tuition and the budget for the university keeps getting cut, where does the money come from to actually operate the system?
Yeah, so the UW system has had to be creative in how it adjusts its budget with a tuition freeze since 2013. So one thing that they've done is try to attract more out-of-state or international students who pay much higher tuition. So that way you are increasing your revenue stream through tuition by those students. They've also been much more aggressive to seek private donations and grants and philanthropy to try to supplement what their needs are on campus. So they're trying to find alternative sources of money to essentially increase to meet their cost needs if they can't grow their in-state tuition because of freeze, or they can't grow their state tax funding because of lawmaker decisions.
What do we know about unscrupulous lenders? We had a caller, Mary Kay, who called in to say that she had an experience where a lending company was dishonest about how much interest she would have to pay. How big a problem is this?
I don't know. She should definitely call there are state regulators and federal regulators of loan lenders. And so if she was misled or has a fraudulent situation, then she should report that to authorities, and that may be able to help her immediate situation. But there are concerns. This is part of the problem that if you've been following higher education over the past decade with for-profit institutions, a lot of those ended up going under because there were concerns about very aggressive loan situations and the college institutions being misleading about the interest rates that students would have to pay or how much what they would actually get out of their degree. So it's not uncommon in higher education, but there are definitely institutions in place to try to help people that are in those situations.
We're just about out of time here. One of the things that you mentioned in your article, Lawrence University in Appleton has a program called Full Speed to Full Need. Briefly tell us what that's about.
Yeah, so like a lot of colleges across the state, there's been this push to try to increase financial aid for students through philanthropy. And so the idea is to lower the amount of unmet need, this measure that looks at how much money can a student not pay because of their family income situation or because of they don't have access to grants or loans. And so it's specifically targeted towards the families who are most in need for financial aid, where if they do not get that financial aid, they can't go to college or they can't afford to pay for college. So that's been a common thing across the state, is to try to narrowly target these families who are in a situation where if they don't get a little additional money, then college is out of reach.
We had a caller who called in to say that colleges are also raising extra money by raising other fees. And so it's not just tuition that students pay for. Very quickly, is that something that's going to be a problem?
Yeah, I think fees are constantly on the radar of lawmakers and students. So lawmakers set some fees at colleges for public colleges, and then students will also set some fees. And that's a perennial debate about what those fees should be. And sometimes it depends on what students want their campus community to look like and what programs they want available. And lawmakers are debating in a similar way about what programs they want to pay for on campus. So it's a very common debate in college affordability, okay. And it does impact how much students pay.
All right, Keegan Kyle, thank you very much for joining me this morning. I appreciate your time. Keegan Kyle is an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network in Wisconsin. His piece about student debt was the genesis for this program. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.